Da skjønner jeg.
Please look at let's go through the precious garland. The highest status is considered to be happiness, definite goodness, liberation. Verse number four, then the next two lines. And verse number five. So, end of verse number five. So, what these lines show is our objective. In the temporary sense, the short-term goal is higher status. So in order to attain liberation, and we need to have intelligence, which can actually differentiate between what is right and wrong. And so therefore, it is important to be born as human beings, otherwise it's going to be very difficult. And then, on the other hand, as we all do not want suffering and want happiness, and on this basis of human life, we can actually do practices to achieve this goal. And so as it is said here, high status is happiness, and so it refers to the birth as humans and gods or deities. So even in the non-Buddhist traditions, they have the practices of concentration, single-pointed concentration, although I do have not yet heard any detailed explanation of form and formless rans, rupa and arupa dhatus, according to the non-Buddhist traditions, but I have met with non-Buddhist practitioners as well as scholars who actually are learned in the philosophies. And so for the Buddhists and non-Buddhists, the three trainings of morality, concentration and wisdom are common. So then, what is the difference between the three trainings of the Buddhists and non-Buddhists? The three trainings within the Buddhist system is practice on the basis of understanding selflessness, whereas the non-Buddhists do their practice on the basis of the thesis of Atman or soul. So, Guenjin Jamyang Shepa has said that the difference between those who assert a self or Atman are non-Buddhist, and those who reject the Atman or soul theory are Buddhists. Which means that an object of apprehension of or a conceptual mind of a view which actually holds on to some independent self is held by the non-Buddhist traditions. So all the non-Buddhist traditions have that view. Whereas in the Buddhist the tradition rejects such an independent self. And therefore, the Buddhist, since the three trainings, the practice of the three trainings within Buddhism is explained on the basis of understanding the selflessness, and therefore, in order to reach liberation, since this grasping or clinging to an independent self is the a hindrance to that, that we need to gain insight into selflessness. So, since the goal, the ultimate goal in Buddhism is nirvana or liberation, and that is hindered by grasping at an independent self. Therefore, self, the understanding of selflessness is the means to for us to reach liberation. And therefore, on the within that understanding of selflessness, when you do the three practices of practice of the three trainings, they become the higher trainings of morality, concentration, and wisdom. And so we have three trainings, the practice of three trainings, which are common to Buddhist and non-Buddhist traditions. And then by rejecting self, the view of self, and doing a practice of morality, keeping morality, and developing single-pointed concentration, and so and developing wisdom becomes the Buddhist practice. So in the Buddhist texts, there we find mention of the three realms of existence. So it's quite difficult to try to demonstrate or prove that without resorting to the scriptures. So I asked also some non-Buddhist teachers, why do we need? Why are there the three realms? And they did not have any good explanation except saying that there are these three. So to be born in the form realm and formless realm, you need to actually develop single-pointed concentration on the basis of which you actually reach those realms. And then within the form and formless realms, there are degrees of subtlety of this concentration as well, which has to do with the mind as well, with the degrees of subtlety of the mind itself. So as you go to the higher realms of existence within the form or formless realm, the mind becomes subtler and subtler. And so in the desire realm, we have the five sensual objects of senses. And then accordingly, we have attachment to them. And so what you do is you try to restrain yourself or your mind from distracting, getting distracted to these sensual objects so that your sensory perceptions do not become servants of the sensual objects. And then you go inwards and develop single-point concentration and then reach the form, the concentration realms, and within which there are 17 different levels. And still you can go, the mind can go subtler into concentration and absorption, and you reach the formless realms. And within that form, the formless realm, there are four levels which are posited on the basis of the subtlety of the mind. So you restrains your mind from getting distracted by the sensual objects, and then go to when your mind becomes subtler and you develop single-point concentration, then you lead yourself to the formless realm. And if you go subtler into the subtler state of mind, then still you actually go to formless realms. So we actually cannot prove these things through reasoning as such. If you have the experience and you remember the form and formless realms, you may be able to say that, of course, I have this experience. I was in formless realm, formless realm, and form realms. So one of my friends and non-Buddhist Hindu masters have said that someone who was his student could actually remember some necklace that he was wearing in a previous life or something. And so in this way, we can prove past lives on the basis of memory. So when you are able to develop some concentration, absorption of mind and single-pointed concentration, then there is also a possibility of actually being able to see your past life. I have some friends who can actually do that. So when you have, if you have done some practice in the past life, then that could also have some impetus on your mind in this life to be able to remember that past life. So I have also met children who could remember their past life in Kanpur in India. There was one girl who could very clearly remember her past life. It was so convincing. That she was actually a girl in her previous life, and her parents in that life were still alive when she remembered her that life in this life. And so she, in the end, she had four parents, from two from the past life, two from this life. So since there is something to recall, she was able to recall it. So of course things change momentarily. What was there in the last year had already changed, and similarly what was there as sentient beings in that last year actually had ceased. But we can remember it, we can have memory, and therefore say that of course it was there last year, such and such thing was there. And so, because of our memory of a past life, we can say there is a past life. And so this non-Buddhist teacher, a Hindu teacher, told me that because there are people who can remember their past lives, we can actually use that reasoning to prove that there is a past life. And in Dharmakirti's Pramana Vartika, the commentary on valid cognition, it is actually said that the past life is proved on the basis of our mind, because mind cannot be caused by something which is not substantially a mind as such. And then, of course, that has also to do with causality, law of causality. Let's first take tea and bread. Please say your blessing. So within these three realms of existence, we have the five sensory perceptions. And then there is particularly the what is known as contact, which gives rise to some experience or feelings. And then accordingly, on the basis of those sensations or feelings, we develop attachment to things that we see or hear or taste and so forth. And so the things appear to these senses, the five senses, and then that from that we draw some satisfaction. So on the basis of these five objects, form, sound, smell, taste, and texture, we actually survive. And so they also give rise to feelings and experiences, and then we also draw some satisfaction from there. So in this realm that we live in, we have the five sense objects and also this intelligence, and therefore within the desire realm, this human life is considered the best form of life. And with regard to the high status or happiness of the high status, we need to also think about the next life. But we don't talk only about that, but also we need to be happy in this life as well. Therefore, the happiness of this high status in this life as well as next lives are our objectives. And therefore, we need to train or cultivate the causes or methods or the means that leads to that happiness. So, the happiness or pain and pleasure have to do with our own experience, which has to do with our mind. And so on the basis of the mind, we can talk about pain and pleasure, experiencing pain and pleasure. For example, when we see a beautiful object, so even if it may be one object, for some it looks beautiful. For another person, others, it looks ugly. And so the one to whom it looks beautiful draws some happiness, whereas the one to whom it looks ugly, there is unhappiness. So if the happiness were to be in the object, the external, then the object should give the same experience to both the persons, but that's not the case. Therefore, the individual also plays a role there. Not only the object, but the mind that is within the individuals also serves as some condition for the happiness or unhappiness. Of course, the object serves as a condition, but mainly it is the internal condition that gives rise to happiness or unhappiness. And therefore, we have to think about, we have to actually go back to the mind itself, which is internal. Of course, physical health or unhealthiness is different. So with regard to the law of causality, the dependent origination in terms of causality, for example, when you are hungry, you can actually eat meal and then feel filled and satisfied. So this is how we do to satisfy ourselves. Whereas most of our happiness or unhappiness or suffering, misery, come due to our way of thinking, our outlook on things. So even if you may be surrounded by miserable conditions around you, if you are calm within, you will not be disturbed. If you have peace of mind within, you will not be disturbed. Otherwise, you'll feel disturbed, even if you may be surrounded by all the necessary necessities in life, all the facilities. And so what affects us most is our mind. For example, someone practicing patience or altruism, love and compassion, when such a person meets with some unfavorable condition, that can turn into actually favorable condition for the person. And even the person may think that, may I have these unfavorable conditions? And Master Nagarjuna in this text also says that may all the miseries of others come upon me, ripen upon me, and may all the good that I have ripen upon them. The virtues and so forth ripen upon others who are infinite as the space. And so, for such a person who is able to think in this way, all the unfavorable conditions can actually turn into a blessing in disguise. So even if the person may see very ugly sights or hear very bad news and so forth, the person will not be disturbed because of the internal integrity. So with regard to pain and pleasure, there is a physical one as well as the mental one. For the animals, they have to do with their pain and pleasure mainly have to do with the sensory perception, sensory experiences. For humans, on the other hand, mental pain and pleasure is much more stronger. So merely having all the necessary conditions in life that are external is not enough for us to have happiness. I have friends who are billionaires, but they are very, as individuals, very unhappy person. So when we have discussions, gradually let out their mental problems. Whereas on the other hand, we see very poor people. In terms of livelihood, they are poor, but they live very happily. And therefore, mental pain and pleasure really affects human beings most. The sensory ones are secondary to us. These days, people who only think about external material development alone think that happiness, they seek happiness on the basis of sensorial experiences. And of course, they are not able to differentiate between the sensorial experience and the mental experience as such, mental conceptual experiences, even in science. Now, in science, they are beginning to see some difference. But traditional scientists thought that mind is only the brain, and there's no other, not something which is separate from the brain. So I met some doctors in America once and had discussions with them, and I said, sometimes in our day-to-day life, without any physical movement, even though we may just sit relaxed, but we have some thought process going on in our mind, and because of that, it affects our body as well. So physically, you are healthy, you have no problem, but because of some thinking, thought process that goes on in your mind, does it have some effect on our body? So I asked them, is it because of some change in the brain, or is the brain being impacted by some other thought? So the doctor told me that it seems it is possible that another factor is affecting the brain, but it cannot be true, he said to me. And therefore, according to him, consciousness is only the brain. But this view is changing these days. Some scientists are saying that because of some change in our thought, that impacts our brain and influences. And they are talking about some change, chemical changes in the brain going on because of some thought process affecting the brain. So whatever the term they may call it, use for this, some brain specialists today are paying attention to this phenomenon. In the West, the psychology in the West, they do not make difference between conceptual mind and non-conceptual mind. Whereas in the Indian tradition, there is difference between these two, the conceptual and non-conceptual minds. Even in the Buddhist, as well as in the non-Buddhist traditions, this distinction is made. So for us humans, we are affected mostly by our mind, the mental experiences. So to actually create happiness in our mind, mere material development is not sufficient. So I've been having discussions with scientists for over 30 years now, and many of these scientists are unbiased, impartial, and real scientists, authentic scientists. So otherwise, there are scientists whom I just talked about saying that it seems there is something like that, but it cannot be true. And they just think that mind is on the brain. And so, over the last 30 years, from my discussions with the scientists, we have benefited a lot, learning a lot about matter to the subtlest particles and atoms and the subatomic particles and so forth. And how about the cosmos, how the cosmos evolved and so forth. We could gain much knowledge from science. The casualty of having discussed with scientists is that I do not believe in the Mount Meru. So I so say that according to Abhidhamma Kosha, it is said that the distance of the moon and sun from the earth is not very much, and that also cannot be accepted. It's only it's mentioned that they are only at a distance of about 50 leagues or something like that, and 55 leagues, and there's only a difference of 5 leagues with regard to the difference from the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun. That's not acceptable. Whereas in science, they talk about Big Bang theory, and which has also to do with the five elements, changes going on in the five elements. And so, with regard to physics and matter, we can learn so much from the science, modern science. Whereas in terms of internal mind, psychology, or emotions, then the scientists have not much to offer to us. With regard to this subject, ancient Indian science of mind is much more profound and vast than the modern psychology. So we can offer much. We hear when in our discussions with the scientists, I'm not trying to propagate Buddhism to them as such. In non-Buddhist countries, for example, also, I do not try to propagate Buddhism as such. I never say that Buddhism is the best religion. I always tell them that it's best to keep to their own traditional religion. However, amongst the scientists, because they pay attention to the workings of the mind, psychology, emotions, and so forth, and also philosophy, they take much interest in learning from our tradition. And therefore, many scientists who have no belief in religion say that Buddhism is something different, has something a different philosophy, and they take interest in Buddhism as well. And so in our tradition, we say that there is a substantial cause of consciousness, which must be a consciousness. And therefore, there are even scientists today who say that although they are not Buddhist or a religious person, but they still can believe in past and future lives because of this reason. And so Einstein has also said that if there is a religion which can go together with the science, it must be a cosmic religion, and that Buddhism is the one which can go together with science. And so what we are talking about here is pain and pleasure on the basis of our minds, which is more, which affects us more than the physical ones. And so for us to have happiness in this life, it is very important for us to develop, to have compassion and love. So many scientists have done experiments and research on the nature of the basic nature of human beings. Of course, grown-ups like us have lots of thought processes going on in our minds, but children, infants who are 3 to 4 months, who have not yet developed language, so we cannot yet speak in the language. I mean, to them, the scientists have shown in their experiments, shown some animations, cartoon animations, in which They showed two blocks actually representing children playing with each other, and one helping the other. And in another movie, they showed the children, these infant children, some cartoon where the one child is trying to hinder another one from moving uphill. So when these two cartoons were shown to the infants, the infants, when they saw the one where the animation where the children are helping each other, even though the infants have not yet developed any language yet, they actually laugh and smile when they see this, the former one. Whereas the later one, when the infants see them, they actually get startled and didn't like it. So this, according to through their experience, the scientists have said that the base shows that the basic nature of human beings is compassion. So even at that age, the basic nature is actually very clearly expressed that we don't like the people hindering us. And so, if we could actually introduce love and compassion to people well, and make them really understand this, the significance, of course we have the seed of love and compassion within ourselves, biologically. And on top of that, if we could actually show them and explain to them, that demonstrate to them that this is really beneficial, if love and compassion is actually beneficial in family, community, and at the global level, if we could introduce it well, we do not need to actually look for the seed from outside, but it's within ourselves. But we need actually to nurture this through the manure, sunlight, and so forth, I mean, so to say. Just as flowers and other plants need the manure, sunlight, and so forth to grow, so this seed of compassion, which is biological in us, must be nurtured. So when we were children, we actually had this innate sort of compassion with each other, one another. In the case of North and South Korean children, if they're kept together, you'll see them playing with each other. They wouldn't have any resentment or anything like that. But as we grow up, because of our indoctrination and education, and then people actually consider the South and North Koreans consider themselves separate.
Play together, isn't it?
So even in the case of Vietnamese, North and South Vietnamese children will play together without any discrimination. So how, if we look at the world today, we have so much trouble. So in America also, in the U.S., there is this racial discrimination against their black. And then within the followers of the same religion, Islam, there is this discrimination between, called fighting on the basis of discrimination, discriminating themselves as Shias or Sunnis. And then in Burma also, we have this problem between Buddhists and Muslims. So because of emphasizing the secondary differences, then the innate quality of love and compassion has become dormant in us. So then we actually begin to differentiate and discriminate ourselves as us and them, between us and them. And on the basis of that, then we develop hatred and so forth, as it is said in Pramanavartika. So, for example, because of some plane crash, if somebody had actually become injured, and somebody else who is fine sees the person, this second person will never ask women which religion the other person is from and so forth. I mean, because the other person is suffering, there is this natural tendency to help. And there's no, the person will not actually look at what background, financial background or family background the person comes from and so forth. But we grown-ups actually today do that a lot. Whereas, and because of that, there are lots of problems. So therefore, we need to actually try to spread the message around for people to be able to see ourselves, everyone to see ourselves as one human being. So if we could nurture love and compassion, we could actually make people become aware ourselves as oneness, I mean, of humanity, and then there will be a real happiness in the world. And so as regards our objective, our goal, we have high status and liberation. And so it says, of these two, wisdom is the chief. So with regard to faith, there is this admiration. Faith, which is an admiration, and then also when that becomes strong, then you'll be able to actually praise that a lot, appreciate that a lot. On the basis of that, then. That leads to a higher rebirth. Since
if the first moment of the consciousness is beginning, born from no cause, then it is against logic. Then we don't have to study or no need to meditate, because you just inject some kind of substance into the mind, into the brain, and then consciousness starts. So that's that's not logical, and it's not going to happen. Some doctors say that when some people are unhappy and sick, they say just relax. Relax means just let the mind rest. It doesn't mean just lie down on the bed and feel anger and tense and stress. Relax means don't think of desire, attachment, hatred. Think on those things. And just so when you have compassion in the mind, it's relaxing. If you have anger, it is not relaxing. It is stressful, because anger comes from insecurity and fear, and that comes from the strong sense of I. If you feel everybody is same, equality, then automatically the ego sort of subsides and becomes weaker. We as social animals, we spontaneously have, the more we have this sense of equality between yourself and others, there is a sense of brotherhood, a fellowship. On the other hand, if you just think of yourself as more important, you know, strong ego, then that leads to stress and tension. So mainly the consciousness, on the basis of compassion, consciousness, we explain the possibility of this mental stream coming from past life to this life and so on and so forth. So life rebirth and the continuity of life is understood through both reasoning and also some people being able to remember past lives and telling their past lives accounts, and which is sort of based on experience, empirical reasoning. So, like by interrogating what that person is saying and trying to verify whether those that account is true or not. And regarding future lives, and we have to think about the impermanence of the consciousness and its stream going to the next life. It's clear? So first we understand through logic and then get conviction and then faith. That's the step. For example, there was a German who is now in his 90s. He once said that faith and logic or valid cognition, reasoning should be combined. Faith should be based on reasoning. So, and the five sense consciousness. So, also by controlling them, controlling one's mind, one subdues or tames one's mind. So, suffering. So understanding how suffering arises and it's a step towards eliminating suffering. The word Dharma means to transform, to change, or to change our actions of our speech, body, and mind. So in order to attain liberation, wisdom is a prerequisite. And of these two, out of the two, wisdom and faith, wisdom is the chief. So we are on stanza number 5. Line 3. In ancient India, the reason why philosophy is studied, the tenets are studied, is because we have to sharpen our wisdom. Therefore, that's the reason why so much focus is given on intellectual reasoning and philosophy and sophisticated reasoning and logic, because that sort of refines the perception, the logic, the wisdom. So faith should be supported by wisdom, and compassion, the practice of compassion, should also be supported by wisdom. So therefore, our temporary and ultimate goals should be mainly achieved through wisdom. according the, so in Buddhism, what is liberation? What is enlightenment? To understand that, first we have to understand what makes us unhappy and causes us suffering. And so in explaining this, you will find explanation in non-Buddhist doctrines as well as in Buddhist doctrine. The word afflictive emotion, in Tibetan we call this nyumung. Nyumung or afflictive emotion means it afflicts the mind when it arises and makes the person disturbed, unhappy, negative. So when afflictive emotion arises, the person becomes disturbed. That's why it's called afflictive emotion. So, for example, if somebody is in a very distress, in a very distraught situation, we also use this word nyumung, afflicted person. So now, afflictive emotion is subdivided into many, many divisions. First of all, we have to, hatred. When hatred arises, our physical facial expression changes, our physical expression change. And the next step is to become violent. So what causes hatred? Mainly, it is desire. It is it's attachment. The more you are attached to your own things, the more you hatred you gives rise to when something obstructs that. So on the other hand, compassion is based on valid reasoning. The more you think in logical reasoning, rational logic, the more compassionate and the more calm you become. Whereas on the other side, attachment is such that the more you analyze it, it becomes sort of, you will see that it has no logical basis. When you see some, look at something and feel something beautiful, so attachment is something which looks only on the beauty side of something, whereas So it is sort of unfounded, baseless. For example, love between family members, husband and wife. So this kind of love is based on attachment. As long as there is attachment, there is love. But when that attachment is gone, that love is also becomes shattered. It's no more there. So therefore, the ordinary love is very much dependent on sensual relationship and not really realistic, not based on real concrete reasoning. So therefore, if you think, analyze this kind of love at a deeper level, after a while you will think, oh, it's sort of like meaningless. Because it's an unfounded, baseless love, it never sort of develops into an extremely enlightened love. Whereas the love which is based on reasoning, like compassion, is based. So that has the ground logic, so it can develop infinitely. So love and more importantly, In Buddhism, we say the three poisons, the three poisonous afflictive emotion, and the kink, like poison, is the ignorance. And regarding this ignorance, which is called timuk or marikpa, or ignorance. So this comes in all texts, all Buddhist treatises, and that is the main sort of subject of discussion and the main object to be refuted, because it is this that attachment, desire, these are based on. In Madhyamika Mulakarika by Nagarjuna says these three poisons minds arise from baseless preconceptions. And what is this baseless preconception? Preconception is sort of a mind which fabricates and exaggerates the nature of the object or the appearance object, either positively too much or too much in a negative way. So when you fabricate and exaggerate something positive about the object too much, you give rise to attachment, and in the reverse, you give rise to hatred. A scientist friend of mine who is now in his 90s, 95, 6, he told me he studied mentally disturbed patients, clients for many, many years. That's his profession. He's specialist in that. He told me that when we are in a state of anger, the object towards which we feel angry appears like the person is very repulsive. But if you analyze, 90% of that repulsive appearance is your own fabrication. He's neither Buddhist nor a religious person. And so such a person says that as a result of decades of study and experiment, so he says this, 90% of that fabrication, that appearance is just your own fabrication. He's an American scientist. He doesn't know that much about the field of afflictive emotion. I met him about 10 plus years ago, and recently I went to see him during a visit to the States. During my recent visit to America, I sort of made it a point to go and visit him, and I reminded him that during the previous meeting he had told His Holiness about this, and he said so. And then regarding attachment, desire, he said if there is no desire and hatred, the world cannot run. So he said something like, with regard to attachment, it is different. It is something not based on affliction, afflictive emotion, fabrication, but only hatred. And another friend of mine told me that regarding emptiness, which says no head, no eyes, no that sort of thing. That person said that this may be relevant during the time of the Buddha. Maybe in today's time, you know, this idea doesn't have relevance. So I, in today's time, you know, in everything is changing so rapidly. Modernization means external things like housing, technology, roads, transportation, communication change so rapidly. But as far as internal mental situation is concerned, the way delusions arise is same as during the time of the Buddha's time and now. And also some people, that's what I told him. Some people say Nagarjuna has said everything is empty, and but that's probably Nagarjuna's sort of an academic invention. It is not a reality. But that's also not right, because emptiness is something which is relevant right and now. Because in our lifetime, in our life, what makes problems is desire and hatred. So if you go to a hospital and say, "I'm hatred and attachment is giving me problem, give me a medicine to remedy that," the people will laugh at you. Also, if you go to a shop, no shop has any some kind of accessory or equipment that can sort of overcome your attachment and hatred. So we know that what makes us unhappy, what gives us so much problem in life is desire and hatred. So we, and these two poisonous minds arise from our exaggerated, fabricating mind. And also our tendency to rely on our fabricating mind, what appeals to this fabricating mind. So if the fabricating mind sort of when we look at objects which through our fabricating mind, the objects appear to us as if they appear they are there from their own accord, and then we trust that appearance, and then that gives rise to these poisonous minds. On the other hand, if we analyze that and realize that reality is not there, such a phenomenon is not there, then we realize that our thoughts are all baseless. So that sort of greatly immediately destabilizes attachment and hatred, and so its emptiness is extremely, extremely helpful and powerful in overcoming our delusions. So nowadays, like quantum physics in modern science and also modern psychology, what is being said by these scientists nowadays, these are really like eye-openers, enlightening. So delusions, afflictive emotions arises from fabricating mind. This is being said by psychologists and also being physicists. So therefore now emptiness, so regarding the philosophy of emptiness, it has this power to destabilize, to go right to the root of our problem. Due to stanza 6,
individualism.
One who does not neglect the practices through desire, hatred for... So if you say, I'm Buddhist because my family is Buddhist, it sort of doesn't make much sense. So and also in India, like there's the caste system, and some of them convert to Islam or Christianity. So this caste and creed kind of discrimination and prejudice problem, and as a result, people convert to other religion because they see and then so as and also due to hatred, you leave one group of organization and go to another one. So now this line says, as contrary to all these things, doing something out of conviction and logic and reasoning. That's what this line is focusing. One who does not neglect the practice through desire, hatred, fear, or bewilderment is known as one of faith, a superior vessel for definite goodness. So it is saying that one should base one's actions on right reasoning and logic and wisdom. So if you, and that kind of person has some kind of understanding, should have understanding on the causality, cause and effect, that nothing arises from no cause or contradictory cause, but must arise from like sort of potential same nature causes. So this is called the law of causality, cause and effect. The result depends on cause and depends on your own personal experience. So if you ask, how does result comes from cause? So if there is no cause, there is no result. At the time of the cause, there is no result. The result hasn't arisen, but because it has the potential, or it is going to give rise to the result, you call it a cause. Same as action, action and actor. So these are all dependent arising. If you don't have a profession, then you cannot have a professional. So, like cause and effect is more sort of easier to understand, whereas it's slightly more subtle to think on, like relativity, profession and professional, action and actor. So, both in this case, both are dependent on each other. The cause, the name designation cause is dependent on cause, on the result, and the.
Then it's wrong.
So there are two kinds of relativity, dependent arising. One is causality, and one is the dependent origination of relativity between two objects. So regarding ultimate happiness, that occurs, that is attained because you have completely uprooted the cause of such a realization, which is the delusions. So liberation doesn't refer to some kind of a pure realm. Chinese friends say, when they say pray this Amitabha prayer, hoping to get born in the Buddha realm of Amitabha Buddha, pure realm. That's not the right idea. And also, there are many different pure realms. Just being born in these pure realms doesn't mean you have attained liberation. After getting born in these pure realms, you have the condition is such, it's the situation is so conducive that you can attain liberation faster. So what is liberation? Liberation means liberation from afflictive emotions, the three poisonous minds within us right now. So liberation is inside us, whereas higher rebirths means on the body, refers to the body. So the ultimate cause of suffering is afflictive emotions. So when that is totally eradicated, uprooted, through counteract measures. To the extent that afflicted emotions are uprooted from their very root forever and completely, that is liberation. So when afflicted emotion is uprooted, suffering never comes back again. It's eradicated forever. So next we have to understand whether this afflicted emotion does have a remedy or not. Counteractive sort of practice. So in order to study on this, the key is the Madhyamika philosophy. The Bodhicitta mind is extremely great. The mind cherishing others. And the Bodhicitta is such that it is the greatest powerful mind to overcome self-cherishing mind. But in our heart, the self-grasping mind and ego, the self-cherishing ego, these two are so like two powerful friends helping each other. So much so that they are so tough and strong in us that it's so difficult to eradicate them. So whereas if you have emptiness and emptiness is the only antidote to uproot the self-grasping mind, and emptiness is helped by the bodhicitta mind to overcome. So ultimately, the real antidote of all the false delusions, afflict emotions in us, is emptiness. And this emptiness wisdom is supported or supplemented, helped by compassion and bodhicitta like that. But the real antidote is always the emptiness wisdom, because emptiness is the... So emptiness is the mind which sort of exposes self-grasping mind, inherent nature. And so it is not bodhicitta which can do that. Only emptiness wisdom can do that. Aryadeva has explained in one of his texts, Judu, that he has attained the state of illusory body. He is an extremely great master and the chief disciple of Nagarjuna. And his knowledge and wisdom is very apparent in his 400 verses treatise, where he has said that the Buddha Dharma its real quality is the path to liberation. So those who seek liberation, then it is Buddhism. Whereas the path to attain higher rebirths is sort of common in many different doctrines, Buddhism as well as in non-Buddhist doctrines, and even in Christian doctrines like that. But for example, the 10 virtuous actions and the 10 abandoning the 10 non-virtuous actions, these practices are there in non-Buddhist doctrines like Hinduism, as well as like Christianity and other religions. It's sort of so these are common practices, whereas the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the path of the Four Noble Truths, is unique to Buddhism only. And the path to liberation is unique to Buddhism only. So that's what Aryadeva is saying in his treatise, that the unique quality of Buddhism is it is the teaching, it is the system that leads to liberation through emptiness, the emptiness of dependent arising. Which means whatever is dependent arising is empty of inherent nature. So when you say like that, then you get a sort of a special feel of what that means. Because you are combining it with the meaning of dependent origination. You're not just saying emptiness. Because you can also, there's also the other terms like selflessness, like that. But when you attach that term, dependent origination, with emptiness, then it has a special power to dispel the two extremes and understand the middle view. Simultaneously. So you know, it's when you just say Buddha is very holy, Sangha is very holy, Dharma is very holy, it doesn't really move you that much. But if you sort of like think well, sort of think on quantum physics, and think on the meaning of the lack of inherent nature, and things appear but lack inherent nature. Things lack inherent nature but also appear. And why this is so? So if I'm not saying I have realized emptiness, but I say this sort of half jokingly. I'm sort of about to realize emptiness. It's not something. It didn't occur because it didn't become like this because in overnight in 1 year or two night, or but like I have worked, been working on this for my entire life. So if you are like Nagarjuna said, if you think on the view of emptiness, so Nagarjuna has said that if you think on the view of emptiness, then there's like absolutely no doubt, no hesitation that you will be able to sort of crumble, shatter this attachment, this craving for worldly pleasure and worldly things. So when that happens, self-grasping mind doesn't have legs to depend on, like sort of it crumbles. When that happens, then delusions, afflicted emotions doesn't have anything to walk on, and then that's how you reduce and sort of overcome afflicted emotions. So therefore, the emptiness view is really like so sort of overarchingly important and indispensable. So it is something like think on and on and gradually you will see the point. Next line: having analyzed well all deeds of body, speech, and mind, those who realize what benefits self and others and always perform these are wise. So whether it's your physical action, action of the speech, or mental action, the three doors of our body, speech, and mind, we should analyze and to see whether they are positive or negative, virtuous, non-virtuous, and see what is beneficial and not beneficial. Happiness and something is our right, and we seek that. So because of that, we should engage in the actions to achieve happiness and dispel or overcome unhappiness. And the person who does that wisely, sort of properly, takes the proper action to do that, is a wise man. The person who is skillful is in seeing what is good for oneself for now and for the future. So now, from this verse onwards, the text is actually, he's only said, talking about higher rebirths. The text begins talking about higher rebirths. So now, like, what actions are there that leads to unhappiness and sorrow and suffering? like killing. And the opposite of killing is not killing. So the practice of not killing should be based on the realization how much the shortcoming it's something you have to. It's not you have to think about very far. You have to killing is something you have to think of in relation to the people around you, the things and object things that are nearby you or in the vicinity. And next is stealing and not stealing. Then forsaking the mates of others, refraining completely from faults. So, which is like forsaking the mates of others is like sexual misconduct and abandoning that. Then telling lies and abandoning that. Then like divisive, harsh, and senseless speech, and abandoning these three, like senseless speech is like senseless speech means like talking about war and gossiping, which or like sort of engaging in sort of. Cross sexual talks. And talking about other people's matters. Thoroughly forsaking and negative covetousness, harmful, which is like wishing to obtain an object belonging to others. And then next is so abandoning that, and then harmful intent, like wishing that something bad befalls someone who you don't like. And the last one is the view of the nihilist, the nihilism. So regarding this nihilism, the view of nihilism, each different religions have their own different sort of standard about this view. But regarding Buddhism, this here, for example, like past life and future life, if there is past life and future life, it is sort of based on logic. If you say it's not there because I cannot see it, or I don't believe in that, or most people don't see it, these are like not right reasoning. If you don't see something, it doesn't mean that object doesn't exist. You know, you have to see that it doesn't exist, but that is not the case. You just haven't seen it. Some German pressmen said that scientists have already decided that there is no past and future life. I told them scientists haven't done that. They just haven't found past life and future life yet. They haven't yet confirmed that it is not there. So this is not finding And finding that something doesn't exist is different. These two are, we must make distinction between these two. So in the many of the things that are said in Buddhism are like based on like thorough reasoning and logic. And what has been proven, and if you say it doesn't exist, then that is a nihilism. What is proven through a lot of reasoning, but if you don't understand that and still say I believe in that, then that is called fabricated wrong view. So, but here, this is like not about the. This is a nihilistic wrong view, saying something doesn't exist, even though it has been proven through a lot of reasoning and experiments and investigations. So these are the 10 virtuous actions and the opposite 10 non-virtuous actions. So the 10 virtuous actions are called the positive white actions, and the 10 opposite of these 10 virtuous actions is the called the 10 non-virtuous actions, the negative. So even in our society, if you stealing, killing, sexual misconduct, and even conventionally, against conventions. Generally, in society, the illegal things, what is called as criminal activities, are mostly involves physical action, whereas speech, verbal actions, are not really sort of bound by law. So we should have some kind of rules that also sort of controls the speech. In society, some people are very skillful liars, and then society even praise them. Oh, that person is really like capable, very intelligent, smart. But actually, they are like expert. Sort of crafty, what you call crafty liars. On the other hand, some people are not crafty liars. They just say very sort of blunt lies, and then people say they are liars. This one is asking about tea. So we'll have a short tea break. Ah, 15 minutes tea break.
Nidra.
That's enough.
So having found the higher status or higher rebirth, if one actually indulges in the 10 non-virtuous actions, you'll not be happy at all. If you go against any law, for example, or such as committing rape and robbing others and so forth, you'll be unhappy. So not only that you are not indulging in the or you are not stained by the non-virtuous actions, you also help others to avoid them. Therefore, verse number 10, is that not drinking intoxicants, a good livelihood, non-harming, respectful, giving, and so forth. So honoring the honorable and the love. Practice, in brief, is that, is said. So with regard to taking alcohol, the first one, if you become really alcoholic, then when you are actually disturbing your own health, and even if you may not be harmed, I mean, health-wise, but other people will actually look down upon you, saying, oh, that person is really alcoholic. And it'll actually hamper your service to other sentient beings as well. And then having a good livelihood is not being stained or by not living wrong living. So sometimes in order to gain honor or fame, you may indulge in wrong livelihood, but it will actually not help you, it will harm you. And so you should be honest in your living, in making your living. That is what is meant by a good livelihood. And then non-harming. And then respect, non-harming also includes killing, especially in the case of execution of criminals. I am actually signed one of the signatures of banning life sentence. What's that? Death sentence. So when you do such thing, you should not actually look down upon the other person for whom you are trying to help, thinking that you are someone who is helping that person to so that they may not have to face death sentence. So you actually have to look, hold yourself lowly and be respectful to others as well. So if you may be helping someone, there's difference in doing so with respect and with some kind of self-importance that you give to yourself. And then honoring the honorable means that you should not have pride or arrogance, but you honor or respect the lamas, your teachers, and people with knowledge and experience and so forth. Even the non-Buddhist traditions, practitioners, say that when they also talk about respecting one's parents and also respecting people with knowledge and learned people. And so they also talk about five different principles that they uphold. So honoring the honorable refers to such things. And then love, It's not about actually like doing some business. If you help others, you'll gain something from them. That's not how you do. How you show love, but with, only with a sense of caring about others. With a sense of caring of others, you should help to help. And you should not expect that others would actually be happy or be loving towards you if you show love towards them as such. So when you have love, then you will also be able to also generate this sense of wishing others to be out of suffering as well. And so for yourself, you avoid the ten non virtuous actions, and also to help others, you avoid these practices, giving up alcohol and so forth. And so these 16 should be practiced. That is what is meant by practice. In brief, is that. So there are 10 non-virtuous, practice of 10 virtuous actions plus these 6. So practice is not done by just mortifying the body, for one has not forsaken injuring others and is not helping others. So merely by practicing austerity does not mean that you are helping someone or others. And then verse number 12, those not esteeming the great path of excellence, doctrine, bride with giving ethics and patience, afflict their bodies, taking an aberrant path like a cow path. Their bodies embraced by the vicious snakes of the afflictive emotions, they enter for a long time the dreadful jungle of cycling existence among the trees of endless beings. And then the ripening effects of 10 non-virtuous actions are given from verse number 13. Results which will be similar to the cause are such that if you kill, a short life comes through killing, much suffering comes through harming, poor resources through stealing, enemies through adultery, from lying arises slander, from divisiveness, parting of friends, from harshness, hearing of unpleasant, from senselessness, one's speech is not respected, covetousness destroys one's wishes, harmful intent yields fright, wrong views lead to bad views, and drink to confusion of mind. Through not giving poverty, through wrong livelihood deception, through arrogance, a bad lineage, through jealousy, little beauty, a bad color or complexion comes through anger, stupidity from not asking the wise. These are effects for humans, but prior to all is a bad transmigration. Opposite to the well-known fruits of these ten non-virtues is the arising of effects caused by all the virtues. And so the effects of virtuous actions or karma are unlike those of the non-virtues. Desire, hatred, ignorance, and the actions they generate are non-virtuous. So in short, that is the result. So Buddhism, the teaching of the Buddha is a means to overcome our negative emotions. So first, you restrain yourself, refraining from the non-virtuous actions. And then in the middle, you get overcome or... And so by avoiding non-virtuous actions, you also generate or cultivate the virtuous actions for higher rebirth. And then in the middle, you get rid of the grasping at a self. And then ultimately, you get rid of even the stains left by them in order to reach Buddhahood. So whatever teaching of the Buddha there is, whether it's we are talking about the three types of beings, teachings pertaining to three types of being and so forth, are to overcome our negative emotions. As the 400 verses says, first get rid of non-meritorious karmas. In the middle, get rid of grasping itself. And then in the end, get rid of all views, distorted views. And that is a vice. So from non-virtues comes all suffering and likewise all bad transmigrations. So unmeritorious karmas or actions will lead to very intense a state of life where there is intense suffering, such as lower realms of existence. From virtue, all happiness, happy transmigrations, and the pleasure of all lives. So, meritorious karma. So, because of our grasping at some true existence, independent existence and things, we also may engage ourselves in practices where we refrain from non-virtuous actions. So, for example, in the case of Vinaya practice, you do keep the monk's vows and so forth. Taking into account the fact that you will suffer if you indulge in non-virtuous actions. Whereas in the Bodhisattva Jnana, if you harm others, the understanding is that if you harm others, then you will, not only that you will suffer, but you are actually causing suffering to others. And so you are actually avoiding, restraining harming others more than just thinking about your own suffering. So by creating meritorious karmas, although it may serve as a cause for samsaric life, it will lead to higher rebirth. And then when it's coupled with single-pointed concentration, you may create unwavering karmas to be born in the concentration realms. And so those also are meritorious karmas, but non-meritorious karmas lead you to the bad transmigrations. So all these are karmas that lead us to be born in samsara, because they are rooted in our true grasping at true existence in things and self. Verse number 23, through these practices one frees one. 22, desisting from all non-virtues and always engaging in virtues with body, speech, and mind. These are called the three forms of practice. So, avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions and also the 10 wrong livelihood and so forth. And so you actually train yourself in cultivating the causes for higher rebirth. So not only do you try to refrain from physical non-virtuous actions, but also you refrain from committing non-virtues through your speech as well as mind. So rebirth. And through these practices, one is freed from becoming a hell-being, hungry ghost or animal. Reborn as human or God, one gains extensive happiness, fortune, and dominion. So, so through concentrations, immeasurables, and formlessness, one experiences the bliss of Brahma and so forth. Thank you. Thus, in brief, are the practices for higher status and their fruits. So whether you believe in religion or not on this in earth, so if you could actually avoid the 10 non-virtuous actions and also the other indulging in alcoholism and so forth, if you could live a very honest life, and then practice compassion, love, and also giving a generosity and so forth, which are also taught in the religions, we can deal with the gap, rich and poor, between rich and poor. So for that, of course, Marxist economic theory of equal distribution is very, very good. So it's all in this. So South Koreans. So for in your eyes, I should go to actually North Korea because of being Marxist. But they are not following Marxism. They're actually living a totalitarian system, under a totalitarian system, they're narrow-minded.
So despite the capitalism, some gap, rich and poor, but still you have freedom. You have rule of law, so much better.
So everywhere in the world today, if you visit a city, for example, the rich live their own, have their own lifestyle, and then if you go to the countryside, you can see their lifestyle is different, and then there are people who live very poorly. So there's huge gap between the poor and the rich in this world. So during the Cultural Revolution and so forth, the Chinese tried to get rid of this gap. Great Leap Forward. During the Great Leap Forward, they tried to do that, but they couldn't. So the rich people actually must work harder to give facility to the poor ones to for their education and also for their economic to raise their economic standard. So one rich family from Mumbai once came to me for blessing, and I told them, I have nothing to give blessing to you, but you have this source of blessing because of your wealth. And so I told them to actually give education to, and actually train the poorer people in Mumbai so that they could actually develop skills. Small-scale industries could be developed in their areas, and that would really be a blessing for you. And I used to talk about this in Africa. One time I was in, there's huge gap between rich and poor. I was once in Gabon. In the city, we had some formal ceremony. There were French. Their lifestyle, the rich people's lifestyle, were quite extravagant. Albert Schweitzer, Schweitzer was helping the African people in the villages in Gabon. And so they actually invited his institution. Invited me to Gabon. So when I visited some villages, as soon as I crossed the border between the city and border of city and reached the countryside, the children were naked, and they have actually killed a duck which was actually bleeding, just killed. So they were living like primitive people, very poor, very sad. The rich people were living their own way of life and living a selfish life. And very, it was very sad. So even in Mumbai, for example, sometimes when I visit the cities, I could see some structures being built. And for marriage, actually, they were spending hundreds of thousands of rupees to build such structures. So I tell people that this is really senseless, because after the marriage ceremony, it will be destroyed again. And instead of building such huge structures with so much money, you could actually buy food stuff such as fruits, bread, cheese, and so forth. And then truck loads of these food stuff can also go around the city to feed the poorer people, because then what can happen is the poorer people would be fed, and they would even have their prayers for the couple, the bride and the groom. So otherwise, just spending money just like that, senselessly, could actually create more jealousy within the poorer people. And so it's a waste of resources and causing jealousy in the poorer people. So far, people have not followed my suggestion. Perhaps people may... It's been about 10 years since I have been saying this, so... maybe they are thinking that it's none of your business. So if I could sometime at some point go to Mumbai or Delhi and take part in this kind of distribution of foodstuff to the poorer people, it would be good. Even if I may be old, if I could do that while I might be limping. Korean abbots could do that while their hats shine so much. So reducing this or eliminating the rich poor gap, I used to tell in Africa also that the rich people should give education and also give skills to them, to the people, the poorer people, so that the rich don't get poorer, the poor people don't get poorer. But better. You have in Korea, you have Samsung company. It's a huge, big company.
So you see, their profit, from their profit, utilize poor people. Firstly, give education and some facility for help.
Then give them some training. Like that. That's the only way. So all this depend is the sense of concern of others will be. Without that, self-centered attitude, selfish attitude. No matter what sort of economic system, like socialism, just a word, lip service. It's reality. Now China, huge gap, rich to poor. Although socialist country. Led by Marxism.
So as practitioners of religions, we need to serve others, to help others. But many of us actually live very selfish life. And there are people who do business with Dharma. So if you cannot actually discipline your mind, there's nothing much we can do. So the doctrine of definite goodness, from verse number 25, on page 4, are said to be said by the conquerors to be deep, subtle, and frightening. So the doctrine or the teachings for definite goodness is the teachings for liberation, attaining liberation. All the religious traditions have different messages, many different messages in them, but the teaching where the means to overcome the negative emotions or destructive emotions is only given in the teaching of the Buddha. Because the real path leading to liberation, to which is to say that to overcome negative emotions, is understanding of emptiness. Although in all the religious traditions there are teachings which may may lead their practitioners to highest rebirth. So in our day-to-day life, we see things in a certain way, but when you understand emptiness, what is said is that things do not exist the way they appear to us. So the things appear to us as if they have some objective existence. So, but when you actually search for that independent objective existence in the things, you cannot actually find, just as quantum physics also says. So our attachment to oneself is because of this appearance which we actually grasp so much and as being true, and therefore we have attachment, anger, hatred, and so forth. So when you are told that things do not exist the way they appear to us, we become surprised, of course. And even amongst the philosophical systems within Buddhism, the Chittamatras say that the things are not just reality is not as the Madhyamakas say. So, for example, Master Asanga, although he himself as an individual person was said to have reached already the third bodhisattva ground, which means that he has already gained the direct insight and experience of emptiness himself, but for the purpose of serving others, helping others who need the Chittamatra view to understand the reality according to their mental disposition, then he has taught the Chittamatra school, and he became the chairman of the Chittamatra school of philosophy, and in that according to that system he has said that other masters like Master Nagarjuna and so forth actually have fallen into nihilism. So as I said yesterday, Niels Bohr was actually shocked when he actually searched for things and whether they have some objective existence, and not being able to find that, he was shocked. So that may be some degree of some kind of an experience of selflessness, but even in regard to me, I have had the experience of the lack of substantially independent, self-sufficiently existing self. So when that happened, there was some kind of a shock in me, some kind of a lightning sort of thing that I felt in my heart. So because of this kind of experience, even with this kind of experience of lack of substantially self-sufficiently existing self, I could actually confirm that, oh, the people or beings do not have such a way of existence, which is the way they appear to me. But when I actually shifted my focus to the body or the psychophysical aggregates, then I could feel that I still have this grasping of some true existence in them. Therefore, this confirmed to me that I had just realized only a very gross level of the selflessness. So selflessness that is explained here is that I explain here is quite subtle. So I knew one professor, from Bihar in India. He was a university professor, and he had faith in Buddhism, and then later he took ordination, monk's ordination from me, bhikshu ordination, fully ordained monk. And one time we were talking about selflessness, I told him that there is no self. Self does not exist. Objectively, at that very point, he actually, his whole body shook. So So when you are not able to differentiate between not having any inherent existence and not existing, then that kind of fear happens. So otherwise, people might ask, why does the Buddha say there's no form? I have this body, this is a form, and I can hear sound. What does it mean? What does it mean when he says there's no form, no sound, no texture and so forth, no eye faculty and so forth? And so, therefore, this teaching of the doctrine of the definite goodness is deep and subtle. And as Nagarjuna says, the Buddha's based on the true truths give the teachings. The true truths are conventional and ultimate truths. So this is taught on the basis of how things appear to us and how things are in reality. So the way things are, in Tibetan the word is ne luk, which means how things exist, not just how they appear to us. How things actually are has to be understood. So there is a conventional way in which the things exist, and then when you go deeper, you can actually go into the final reality of how things are. So which means that things cannot be found within the designated object when you search for the designated object. So these changes that are going on in things, momentary changes, why do they happen? And why do the effects depend on their cause? If an effect were to have any independent existence, it would not have to. It should not depend on its cause. But many of the things that we usually take for granted, being these, that, and so forth, when you actually look for them and search for them within them, object itself, you cannot find. For example, in the case of three times, you cannot find even the present when you actually look for it. So when you go into the very subtle moment and say, where is the present? Half the second is gone, half of it is yet to come. And so there is nothing that you can point to as being present. And if there is no present as such, then you cannot have past and future as well. But we actually posit our things, or without doing this kind of analysis, but So if you look for things, search for them within themselves, you cannot find anything at all as being this or that. Because things are, because things do not have any inherent existence, therefore this shows they are dependent. So Guna Rinpoche says that all these things are designated on the independence on many factors. And so then the seventh Dalai Lama also says, not things are baseless if you actually search for them. This reality, although the things are in reality without unfindable, yet because of our grasping at some true independent existence, we are bound in samsara. Because of our this, then we have the attachment and anger and so forth, and which actually bind us in samsara, and we are ruined in samsara by them. And we have suffered so, for so long in samsara until now. If there is no way out of this bondage, then we could just relax and take alcohol and so forth. But that's not the case. We can actually get out of this bondage. Then if you then you should think about emptiness for that. And then you will actually have the aspiration to liberation through the understanding of emptiness. So I have some friends who are students of philosophy, Buddhist philosophy. One friend actually came to see me, and he had some physical problem, lung problem, as it said. So he told me, I asked, why did he become sick of this? And he said, because of meditation on impermanence. So this is because the person has not been able to get a good grounding in emptiness. If you have good grounding in understanding of emptiness, you will not have such fear when you think about impermanence of and death. If you just repeated the thing that, oh, I may die, I will die this any time, and so just without any basis of understanding of emptiness, then this kind of fear of death can happen. So not realizing this reality of things, we are bound by this clinging to true existence. So you have to demonstrate and prove that things do not exist the way they appear to us. And so, to the childish, voice number 25, last line, to the childish who are not learned. So because of our attachment to oneself, then at the time of death, we become afraid. We all have been thinking of oneself. The sense of I has always been there, strong in us. And we have always have this notion that there is a solid kind of concrete self in this body. But if it were there, but this kind of self is solid and concrete self is not there, which governs the body and the mind. And then the body and mind, the psychophysical aggregates also cannot be found within themselves. When you actually break them up and look for the body or the mind or other aggregates. So when this basis of the person, a basis of designation of a person, the psychophysical aggregates, cannot be found, when searched for, how can you have a self which is designated on the basis of them? So Master Nagarjuna later on in this text also says the form is merely name. And in the end of that verse he says even that name does not exist. So that which is to show that we need to destroy all objectification in things. soul, an independentless self, which appears as if it has some concrete existence, has never existed since time beginningless. And because of that, I'm not, I will not be, I have not, I will not have. That frightens all the childish and extinguishes fear in the wise. So how we are actually, how we suffer through the force of these negative emotions is shown by verse 20, by Master Nagarjuna, when he says that, when karma and delusions are overcome, you have liberation and so forth. So by him who speaks only to help beings, it was said that all beings have arisen from the conception of I. So this person comes from this conception of mine and are enveloped with the conception of mine. And so from this, then the ignorance, this ignorance starts karma and so forth, the rest of the chains of the 12 links. So as long as we have this psychophysical aggregate, which are the result of our karma and delusions, we will have suffering. And the Buddha, when he says this is suffering in his teaching on the Four Noble Truths, he's not referring just to the suffering of suffering or painful experiences that we know as suffering, or nor was he referring to the changeable suffering, which even the non-Buddhist practitioners actually acknowledge as being in the nature of suffering or unsatisfactoriness. But if the Buddha was pointing to this conditioned existential pervasive of suffering, this chain of birth, called the constant rebirth with psychophysical aggregates which come from the karma and delusions, is what is referred. So Pensa Narasan Chökyen says that even animals do not want suffering. They also know suffering in that sense. And then the non-Buddhist practitioners also are able to recognize the changeable sufferings. So His Holiness was saying that he was about to confuse between the hour hand and the minute hand on the clock there, on the wall. So I have a story to tell. When in the past we did some ritual, we had some Gyume Tantric College monks to help with our ritual, and they have actually set a time when the torma, the ritual cake, one of the ritual cakes, should be actually taken away or thrown, and so one of the government officials, Tibetan government officials, was there to supervise the ritual. And so since the monastery, the Dantri College monks actually did the ritual very slowly, this official came to the monk, one of the monks, and said, "We have to finish the time at this time." And he brought actually a table clock in front of the chant master and said, "You have to finish the ritual at this time." He pointed to this. And so the chant leader had no experience telling the time, looking at the watch or the clock. And so he was looking at it. So he was actually looking at the second hand, and since it was moving so fast, he did his ritual so hurriedly. And when the ritual was finished, so it was not yet time to finish it. So what happened? And he said that I was looking at the second hand, and therefore it was going so fast.
So,
So I leave it here. We have finished the verse 27. Tomorrow we'll have review session at 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock. Review session at 1 o'clock. Ba na tenba nyushin do seva tan tenzi punushin do tim. Temba yurin nebe trashi show.